you couldn't find it because it was in your lap.
I lose so many cats that way.
Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to Going Pro, a series prompted by Ed, who sent in a list of great questions for what you need to do in order to go from hobbyist to pro. Today is day 3.
And we're talking about financial prep.
Ooh, okay, so what is his question?
Obviously, the first step in going pro as a writer is to not have any debt. The second is to have a nest egg so you can survive a while if the writing doesn't take off. How big a nest egg? What else should you do? How do you keep health insurance costs from eating you alive?
Okay, so to start off with, I should point out that I wrote a book about this, about the underlying theory anyway, called Business 101. Of you who are subscribers to The Everyday Novelist and supporters will have a copy of it in your rewards posts. You may have to go back a while and find it. Or if you subscribe on Gumroad, you'll find it there as well. Otherwise, you can get it on any of the fashionable ebook, audiobook, and paperback markets around. Mm-hmm. But we're going to go into some more depth in here, and this may wind up being, in fact, you know, this whole series should be the basis for a 201 business book.
Oh.
So anyway, we're going to go into some more depth here, and we have a list.
First, on the matter of debt elimination and or reduction, you don't necessarily have to eliminate all your debt, especially if you went to school. Getting started as a writer before you've paid off your student loans might not be feasible.
That's true, because you'll be paying those until 5 years after you're dead. The advantage of being a writer is it'll be paying you 70 years after you're dead.
No.
They dissolve with death?
They dissolve with
death. That's amazing! So all we gotta do to get rid of your student loans is...
kill me. Fake my death. Fortunately, I'm married to a mystery writer
who might be able to fake your death.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to actually kill you because that would stink. I'd want to keep you around because you're cute, but eventually your corpse would turn green and start growing things. Make it hard to cook in the same house. But with a little needle and thread, I could sew your mouth into that really creepy smile you like to use when you're trying to scare children. Yeah, that one.
Anyways, debt elimination.
You want to certainly deleverage all your consumer debt. Those are super high interest. Deleverage your consumer debt, but you may not necessarily want to get rid of the credit cards because it might be good to keep them in a safe in your house where you don't use them and then be able to bring them out in order to see to an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least keep one for that. You don't want to make it a habit of going to the safe and getting the emergency cards out because that'll put you down the wrong end of the barrel really fast. But, yeah, deleveraging all of your consumer debt, as much of your student loans as you can, and paying off your house as fast as you can. Which brings us to number 2. It's going to be related. You do not want expenses. You want to eliminate all possible expenses. Debt is usually the easiest one for people to eliminate because they're not getting any ongoing utility out of paying it that's obvious to them.
One of the aspects of your question, Ed, was how big of a nest egg do you need? And how big of a nest egg really depends on your lifestyle and your location. Mm-hmm. And it depends on you. The amount of nest egg that we need to live on is going to be different from any of our friends that are in the Bay Area, which is why I left the Bay Area. And it may be completely different from a family of six living in a similar situation to us. So it depends a lot on what life you want.
Well, let's talk about the formula. What you want to do is you want to have a nest egg that will pay your way for a year. You're going to dip into it fairly regularly and then build it up, because writing is a feast or famine type of thing. You will never have a dependable income, which is why you want a year's worth of a nest egg. Now, you can make it work on less, but it's super stressful because we've done it and it's very hard. But because writing is feast or famine, you don't have the regular monthly paycheck you can depend on. And it's really important to keep that in mind, because there will be seasons where you've got a book that's doing really well, and you've got a regular check that's coming in, and it's of a fairly dependable level. There will come a month where that check is much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to know what month that is. And if you allow yourself to get used to having a regular income, you're going to screw yourself.
Yeah.
The nest egg is not what you would use a nest egg for as an employee. As an employee, your nest egg is for retirement, it's for special expenses, it's for a dream second house, whatever it is. Or it's an emergency fund. Mm-hmm. Your nest egg, when you're a freelancer, is none of those things. It's your reserve capital.
Yeah.
It's like the generator that you hook to your house in case of power outage. Your nest egg is just the amount of fuel you've got to run that generator, and that's it. You're going to dip into it fairly regularly, and you're going to replenish it fairly regularly, and you need to be prepared to use it as a reserve account as opposed to a nest egg. You put your savings somewhere else.
Yeah.
Now, you want it to be about a year's worth of expenses, which means that if you want to get to pro faster, you drop your expenses as much as possible. And the way you do this without really disrupting your life is you start looking at what you're paying for and why. There are a lot of things we all pay for, especially when we're living a urban or suburban lifestyle as an employee, that are luxuries without real benefit. Food deliveries. Now, I'm not talking about someone does your grocery shopping for you because you have no time. That's a high-end type of service. I'm talking about, hey, let's get some food out tonight and we'll have Uber Eats bring it home. That's not much, but oh boy, does it add up fast.
Exactly.
Small marginal luxuries like that are the easiest to cut. They don't cost much, they don't deliver much, but in aggregate, they drain a lot from your bank account.
There's kind of a joke in the last 5 or 6 years about avocado toast and lattes being the reason that people can't afford to buy their own home.
It's actually true.
And it's true to a degree.
No, it's actually really true. So those small luxuries really add up. Second place is the small luxuries that are ritualized that can be substituted. I guarantee you that if you're a Starbucks customer, you go there every morning, you spend more in 2 months on Starbucks than you would spend on a cappuccino machine for your home. So buy a cappuccino machine and make cappuccino every morning and relocate that Starbucks ritual to your kitchen and get some extra family time out of it. Doesn't work if you hate your family, but otherwise it actually increases your general well-being. And it decreases your overall expense outlay to the point where you could afford even nicer coffee than you can get at Starbucks, or you could even get the same coffee and pay way less for it every year than paying for it now.
Oh, yeah.
The next step after stuff like that, where it's related to stuff like that and takes you a next step further as well, is menu planning.
Mm-hmm.
Most people who live in the suburbs, who live in the city, shop every couple days. The store's on the way home, you don't know what you're going to want to eat when you go away in the morning. You eat according to what mood strikes you. What you're doing is you're using the food you consume to moderate your mental health. Change that habit so that you shop once a month for everything but your perishable vegetables and fruits, and once a week or once every 2 weeks for perishable fruits and vegetables. You will spend less, and you'll have higher quality food because you'll be doing less takeout, you'll be doing less impulse buying, and if you learn to cook, or if someone in your house learns to cook, you'll be exploring a new aesthetic space, which is something you can get bonding experience out of, you get more personal enrichment out of, and it opens more of the world to you than if you're eating out 2-3 times a week and then impulse shopping the rest of the time, which is what most people do.
Something that a lot of people have had to start doing for the first time this year because of the pandemic
Yes.
Planning bulk shopping.
Yes.
And if you live in the country or the suburbs, you tend to do bulk shopping anyway, because we tend to have the space.
Yeah, in some of the suburbs, it depends on how far out you are. You have the space to do it in the suburbs, but most people don't anymore because of the commute distance and the lifestyle.
Good point. Good point. But as someone who is freelancing and has inconsistent money, one of the things that you do with your nest egg is you have the option of buying in bulk when you have that money available. Buy a whole cow or something like that instead of paying premium for the same meats.
Mm-hmm.
You don't actually have to buy a whole cow, but it helps.
You get higher quality meat that way.
Every supermarket will have seasonal sales. Take advantage of those when you have that extra cash and load up your freezer.
Yeah, at Thanksgiving, don't buy a turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. Buy 5 turkeys for the year.
Yeah.
We're sitting right now on, and we're, keep in mind that we're living in a closet at a relative's house because we're sheltering for COVID and prepping for our cross-country move.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been basically homeless for 5 years. We're sitting on 8 months worth of meat right now.
Yeah.
4 months worth of pickles and canned vegetables that we pulled out of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Including some that we gleaned from a neighbor who had harvested all she wanted and was going to plow it under.
Mm-hmm. A bunch of frozen fruit that we picked from a U-Pick farm.
Mm-hmm.
And about half of that is going to be processed into jam.
Mm-hmm. We're in a situation, and I'll tell you how much we spent on all this in a minute here, but we're currently in a situation where we could literally not leave the house for 8 months. Never go hungry, never go thirsty, at all. Our cost of living is almost zero for the next 8 months, aside from what we're paying the people whose closet we're living in. And the cost of getting ourselves in that situation was $600 and about 30 or 40 hours of work.
I would say that's about accurate. Yeah. And most of that was the beef.
Yep, $600 and 30 or 40 hours of work, and we got enough to sustain ourselves for 8 months, including enough food to sustain our dog for 8 months. If you're used to shopping like most people shop in a grocery store a few times a week, you're really, it's not just that you're paying a premium for the convenience, you're paying orders of magnitude more than what you need to for the same quality food in the same proportions than you would if you were menu planning and buying ahead. It makes such a huge difference. When we moved from the Bay Area, we were making together, what, about $75,000 a year? We moved to a small town for a couple of years where we together made $13,000? $13,000 a year. And we lived better on $13,000 a year than we did on $75,000 a year, including ate higher quality food, had more fun doing it.
Had more leisure time and better exercise.
And about 60% of that cost of living decrease was just changing the way that we dealt with food.
Yeah.
If we didn't change our diet, we just changed the method with which we provided for it.
You do not have to go from luxury cuisine to beans and rice to save money.
No. If you don't know how to cook, it'll be a little bit of a longer road, but you want to learn how to cook. It opens up universes. It's
wonderful. That said, everybody should keep beans and rice in their pantry because that is really good, quick food. And when you're really broke, it can be a lifesaver.
Now, some of the infrastructure you need to buy this way. You need a chest freezer. And if you live in a place where the power could go out, either because of civil unrest or because there's earthquakes or because you've got a weak power grid or because there's storms, winter storms, and lines get knocked down, the first thing you put in that chest freezer is jugs of water up the sides. Because that will keep, those will freeze, and they'll also give you an emergency water supply. Those will freeze, and they'll keep things cold for weeks. Then you buy your cow, or you stock up on your meat on a dollar cost averaging approach, where you buy like 20% more or twice more than you would normally buy every time you go to the store, and just bank the rest. And you start rotating it out. A half cow takes a, what, 11 cubic foot chest freezer, or 9 cubic foot? I can't remember.
I can find this.
While Kitty's looking that up, I should point out, I said the 40 hours worth of work. I want to detail what that work went into. That work includes the menu planning, the driving to pick up the cow from the butchers, the sorting and staging in the freezer.
A small tip for if you buy a half cow or a quarter cow or a whole cow. The butcher tends to pack it in by cuts, but if you store them that way, you tend to end up eating all the steak and roast and then finding the bottom of your freezer full of hamburger and eating tacos for the last 2 months of your beef supply. What we've been doing is pulling everything out, sorting it, and making boxes that have roughly equal amounts of roasts, ground beef, and steak.
Yep. So it includes that work. It also includes the time we spent harvesting, weeding, planting, gleaning, and canning for all the vegetables and fruits. And that includes the time at the Yupik farm. It includes time that we spent rummaging around in the forest picking wild blueberries and blackberries and strawberries. Counts all of that. And that's 40 hours. It was basically, aside from the canning, it's all basically recreation time.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that in order to get this, you have to take a 40-hour work week out in order to do everything. The actual work part of this, the canning part, that's been, what, about 5 hours?
Something like that.
5 hours, yeah. The rest of it was just what it took to tend the garden over the summer and get the cow. And that's just catch as catch can a few times here and there. So how much freezer space will a cow take?
A quarter beef takes approximately 3.5 cubic feet.
Okay.
Which means that a half would be about 7 cubic feet, which is right now like the smallest chest freezer that's commonly available.
Okay.
You can get a 3.5 square foot or cubic foot.
If you've got a family of four, a half cow will last basically 4 months, third of the year, depending on the age of the kids. That's for four adults. If you've got teenagers, it won't last that long. And if you've got little kids, it'll last longer.
Right.
All right, so food and the way that you deal with food is the biggest obvious cost savings there. Minor convenience items, another huge cost savings. And this will run all throughout the household from not just from convenience food, but the way that you get your cleaners packaged, whether you're using paper towels and Kleenex, and the proportions you're getting of different things and how you're staging them through the house. Most of the economic growth over the last 20 years in the retail space has been in differentiation in packaging, by repackaging things for higher convenience levels for consumers who have busy lifestyles. And if you start shopping a little more like a restaurant owner and a little bit less like a harried employee, you're going to realize somewhere between 20 and 40% of your budget for those items just comes right off the top without any real loss of convenience or quality. In fact, quite a lot of the time, it'll be exactly the same stuff in different shaped boxes. Where else can people save? Changing your own oil, actually, will save you a couple hundred bucks every 3,000 miles. Worth learning to do if you don't know how to do it.
Take a look at your entertainment costs, particularly things that you pay for monthly. it's easy to keep track, I think, of your outings in cost. And you know when you go out to the movies as a family how much you've spent. You tend to lose track of how many television streaming service subscriptions you have. Keep track of those. Sure, they're only $5 a month, but if you're not watching anything on Hulu except for 1 month a year, why are you subscribing for 12 months a year?
We've got a couple things in the fall that we like to watch on Hulu, so we subscribe for 2 months a year. And we watch them, and then we unsubscribe, and then we resubscribe. If you're not watching Netflix once a week, get rid of it. Especially if you also have Amazon Prime. Now, they don't have the same lists of things to watch, but if you have Amazon Prime because you order enough from Amazon for the free shipping, you're paying $100 a year, that's $8 a month. You've got all of the streaming video there as well. So Netflix is expendable unless there's specific stuff on Netflix you want to get to and you're watching it fairly regularly. Otherwise, cycle Netflix on and off as well. Okay, so what other places can people trim? We've learned a lot about this over the last few years.
Cars, buy used and pay cash.
Yeah, buy and pay. Okay, before we get to the cars, cash is really important. The more you pay cash, the less you pay. And it's not because of finance charges. It's because cards aren't real. When you swipe a card, you do not feel the cost like you do when you hand over cash. And that creates a mindset shift where you're going to spend a little more here, a little more there, because you're just handing the card over. But what happens in aggregate, according to the studies I've read, is that people that pay with cards tend to spend, every time they use it, 10 to 30% more than they would if they were paying with cash. So that's a really easy way to reduce your expenses permanently, is just pull cash at the beginning of the pay period, and that's your cash allowance for the whole thing. You know, your and budget in whatever it's going to be, your incidental spending, your gas, whatever is in the cash account. Pull the cash at the beginning of the pay period, and if you've got extra at the end of the pay period, great. Throw it back into savings or put it in a separate account for other things, and pull your next bulk of cash out at the beginning of the next thing.
And obviously that doesn't work if you do all of your grocery shopping on Amazon or something.
Well,
but budgeting and deciding how much you're going to spend in cash for local conveniences versus how much you're going to spend for necessities that you have shipped to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, with cars, there's actually several angles. The first, buy a used car and pay cash. No more new cars. When you get to a certain amount of income, you may want to think about leasing for tax reasons. But that's a whole other thing. I mean, unless you're not making six figures dependably every year with your writing business, you don't even need to think about that. Buy used, pay cash, and look, when you go to buy a car, stop thinking the way that we all think when we're buying cars. We all think in terms of, oh, this, you know, I like the way this looks, I like the way it feels, it's nice to drive, oh, look, the fuel economy. Those aren't all bad considerations, but the two things that most people think most about is, what will my friends think of me driving this car? It's usually very subtle, but it's always there. And, oh, look at all the bells and whistles. Doesn't it feel nice to have all this power at my control? Those are the two things you want to banish from your thinking. Trust someone who's been elbows deep restoring a truck from the truck yard the last 2 years, from the scrap yard the last 2 years. Every one of those bells and whistles can go wrong, and will. And the more of them they are, the fewer of them have to go wrong before the car has a problem. You know, if your traction control button gets stuck, well, that's interfacing with the car's computer. You have to fix that, or the car's not going to drive right. So don't get a car with traction control if you can avoid it. Now, the newer the car you get, the more trouble this is going to be, but default to the simplest possible vehicle you can get. Look at maintenance costs and reliability. Get vehicles that last at least 300,000 miles reliably. and buy them when it's 150, 200,000 miles on the clock. You don't spend much, and you get a vehicle that will go for 5 to 10 years before you have to do anything to it. Stay ahead of the maintenance schedule, do the maintenance yourself as much as you can, because when it breaks, if you're already familiar with that car, you're going to have an easier time fixing it than maybe the mechanic will.
Right, and one of the aspects of that is get a car that you can do the maintenance on.
Yeah.
Or that you can conceivably learn to do the maintenance on if you rarely do maintenance on cars.
Yes. Watch Scotty Kilmer's channel to get an idea of these sorts of things. Scotty Kilmer on YouTube is...
And he does car reviews as well.
He does car reviews. He also does tips and tricks for car repair, car maintenance, tells you what sorts of things to look for in a used car.
Mm-hmm.
He's an old mechanic from Houston, and he's a really, really hilarious guy. So we'll link to his channel in the show notes. Now, that's step one of the cars. Step two is get to know your insurance company, because there's going to be a certain number of cars you can have where you'll pay less in insurance than if you had fewer. So in terms of reducing overall expenses, generally it's a good idea to have one more car than you need in case one breaks, especially if you're buying used and they're not under warranty.
Mm-hmm. And especially if you live fairly remotely.
Yes.
And you do not have neighbors that are shouting distance from the house.
Right. So get an idea of how many cars you need and plan out what those cars need to be, get them, and then shop around for an insurance company that'll give you a break for having that number of cars.
And I realize that a number of these finance tips do not make sense outside of the United States.
Yep.
And if they don't, because you live in a European city with incredible public transit.
And you never leave the city, that's, yeah.
Yeah. Feel free to ignore things that don't make sense in your country.
But also look at the insurance you're carrying. You want to be carrying insurance that will do two things for you. It'll keep you from going bankrupt if you hurt somebody, and it will keep you from going bankrupt if someone hurts you. So get your cars insured in such a way that the payout will be something that if you get your car wrecked, where you can afford to replace the car for something similar. Not all policies will do this. Some will only replace Kelley Blue Book value. And with used cars, that can be dicey. So you want an insurance company that will replace for replacement value what it would take to buy that car in that condition on the used market. One of the reasons that we have the trucks we do is that they are just on the edge of being collector's items because they're so reliable and they last so long. So if they get wrecked, the insurance company will have to pay out at a rate where I could turn around and buy a late model used truck pretty easily. But they're also easy enough to work on that if they get wrecked, I could probably do the repairs myself if I needed to, especially given the fact that I now know how to do framework and other stuff like that. So these are things to consider. Look also at fuel economy based on what you're driving. If you're driving 200-300 miles a day, something that gets super good gas mileage is going to trump almost everything else in this category. But if you're not driving much, and if you're working at home and not commuting, then you're not driving much. A car that gets 20 miles to the gallon is going to be just as good as a car that gets 60. Below about 12 miles to the gallon, you're going to really hurt, though, even if you're not driving much. Oh, and stay away from used hybrids, because the batteries wear out, and they're very expensive to replace.
Okay. That's something I wouldn't have known.
Yeah.
Being that I am avoiding hybrids because they're too new.
Well, hybrids are great when they're new. They have incredible economy. They're amazing feats of engineering. But when the batteries wear out, they cost almost as much to replace the batteries as it does to replace the car. They're very expensive. So if you want a hybrid, get a new hybrid, but please pay cash. Car loans are awful things. And they require you to carry levels of insurance that adds extra sets of expenses on top.
Yeah, there's no flexibility because you are required to by the
terms of the lien.
Yeah.
All right. So had we covered expenses and nest egg well enough there?
Oh, I can think of one more thing.
Okay.
Buy not just cars, but as much else as you can.
You've discovered thrift stores this year.
I've always loved thrift stores. Been shopping thrift stores since I was in college. You can get anything.
This is easier for women than for men, but...
This is easier for women than for men, and also for men, it's much more difficult if you are tall.
If you have long torso, then, yeah.
And for both women and men, if you're an outlier in size, it... especially on the higher end where you can't take things in.
Mm-hmm.
But not just clothes, but shoes, and things have evolved a lot in the last 20 years. It's not just your local thrift store and Goodwill. There's a thriving market on eBay and Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist and local online classifieds. Anything that you can get used, do.
Mm-hmm.
Don't pay money for junk. Be ridiculously choosy about quality.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing with shopping on the used market is it takes more time.
It's like fishing. You go to the fish market, you buy a fish. If you want to go and buy something on the used market, you have a list of things that you want to pick up at some point.
Yeah.
And you integrate stopping by the thrift store for a quick look, or checking Facebook or checking Craigslist or whatever your local listing groups are.
Mm-hmm.
Once every few days or once every week or whatnot as part of your routine. It becomes part of the background, and then the things that you're looking for will pop up and you grab them.
Mm-hmm.
You don't make an occasion of it like you do when you go out shopping to a department store. You integrate it as part of the background processes of your life.
And you don't decide, I need a new shirt, go out and get a new shirt. You have things that you are looking for,
mm-hmm.
That you know that you will need, and you look for them, and when you find something that works, you pick it up.
This is a lot like what we were talking about earlier with food. A little bit of forethought saves a lot of money, and in the long run actually saves a lot of time as well. In mm-hmm. the short run, the time investment is different, and so it feels a lot heavier.
Mm-hmm.
But over the long haul, it saves a lot of time as well.
Yeah. And we've picked up a lot of power tools mm-hmm. and hand tools and
I equipment. Outfitted an entire metal shop and wood shop for about $1,500, and most of that was buying the welders and the plasma cutter
mm-hmm.
brand new because I couldn't find used ones that had the features I needed.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, I think the only other two new things we got were the angle grinder and the drill press.
Yeah.
And the only reason I got the drill press is my drill press is on the other side of the country right now, and I needed it now for a project. An entire wood shop and metal shop. It's not that I'll never buy another tool, but I won't need to. Mm-hmm. I literally will not need to buy another tool ever. I might buy some for convenience or for specialized, extra fun, but I'll never need to buy one. Can now do anything I need to on any of our vehicles. I can build a house. I can build furniture.
Mm-hmm.
I can fix anything made of metal. I can build furnaces and have. And this is starting from a standing start 2 years ago when the most I knew about woodworking was how to put up bookshelves and run a table saw and a router. Starting at that point, I renovated someone's house, and then we got out here, and my uncle wood and metal shop there, and so I asked him to teach me how to use some of the tools I didn't know how to use and how to do some basic metalworking. And I had a 3 or 4 week apprenticeship, and since then I've been doing everything.
And learning a lot from YouTube videos.
But most of the things would, that brings us to something else when it comes to home repair. If you can learn to do all the basics of home repair yourself, and it's not difficult, you will save, over the course of any 10 years, you will save yourself thousands of dollars in costs for electricians and plumbers and all sorts of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Although if you are renting, your lease may prevent you from doing certain aspects of the...
they do. Bastards. Still good stuff to know, though.
Yes, good stuff to know. I think that takes us to the next thing, income sources.
Income sources, yes. So you don't just want your nest egg. You want other sources of income.
For a lot of writers and freelancers, that is your spouse's income.
Yep, it could be your spouse's income, and it doesn't have to be a full-time income. It could be a part-time income. It'll be other sources of income include the books that you're already selling before you've gone pro, but it should also include other things. Maybe you can do a little handyman work on the side. Maybe you've got some good thrift stores around, and with a little bit of hustle, you can start flipping items by picking up stuff that's common in your area but rare across the country,
mm-hmm.
buying them cheap and selling them dear online, basic arbitrage operation.
Right.
You control estate sales, pick up books, and set yourself up a bookstore on Amazon and eBay.
Mm-hmm.
Any little businesses like this, anything else that you can get that will generate income outside of your writer business is insurance, because it means that when writing is when your sales are down in your writer business, you've still got other forms of income that aren't dependent on how well the public knows you or likes your voice. And the more of those that you can automate and make actual proper businesses that are under your control, the less time they take out of your life.
Mm-hmm. Something that we talked about with the expenses, and that is kind of related, the important thing is making your expenses lower than your income.
Yeah, the gap between your expenses and your income is the most important number.
Yeah.
The larger that is, the better off you are, because that means your nest egg will build faster. Well, you'll have a lot more wiggle room when you're completely on your own.
Mm-hmm.
You can build up auxiliary savings for other things. You're faster to paying off debt and to paying cash for your vehicles, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
And that's a two-sided strategy, and they're both important. And most people only think about reducing their expenses.
Or increasing their income. But you want to do both.
Right. And the next thing that he asks about was insurance,
mm-hmm.
particularly health insurance.
Yeah. This is all you.
Okay. So there are multiple ways of doing insurance. And one, as with the income, if you have a spouse that has a regular job,
mm-hmm.
and he or she gets insurance through their work, be on the spouse's insurance plan.
Mm-hmm.
It will be cheaper for you in the long run, probably, than most of the other options available.
Yep, so use that as long as you can.
If your spouse's insurance is not good quality or not affordable or non-existent, look into affinity groups. Those would be insurance policies that are sponsored by a professional group or a club. Or a
church group, or the Elks Lodge. Or
anything that is not an employer.
Yes.
Those are pretty rare, but look into any clubs that you are part of to see if those are available to you.
And there are some professional writer organizations that offer them from time to time. CEFWA currently offers them. Novelists Inc., I believe, offers them. There's two or three others that are available in the writing world at the moment.
Mm-hmm. You can always go to the healthcare market.
Vary by state, your state exchange.
Which varies by state. And if you can, look for a broker that deals with small businesses,
mm-hmm.
with writers, or with any other specialized need that you might have. A few years ago, we were looking at RVing across the country and not having a permanent location. And one of the things...
Which we would have wound up doing if we hadn't been jogged off on this sidetrack, but now we just want a home.
Yeah. And one of the things we looked into when we were doing that was an RV insurance broker who specialized in health insurance policies that went across state lines, because the current healthcare market tends to be very localized. It works for your area, and if you are traveling out of state, everything is more expensive for mm-hmm. you than if you go to the hospital down the street from you. So that was something that we looked into. What we're doing right now, though, is we have catastrophic insurance policies that are basically a form of life insurance, and they're brokered by life insurance policies instead of by health insurance. And they're catastrophic injury and illness policies that will pay you in cash for the costs associated with your care and your loss of income for a serious illness or accident.
And those payouts are capped per year.
They're capped per year, and
I think it's what, a $20,000 deductible or $10,000 deductible or something like that?
Actually, no, they're not deductible. They work like life insurance policies. They pay you up to a certain amount, and then after that, you have to cover the costs yourself.
Okay.
And another form of insurance that you can do is a health savings account. And you can either do a health savings account as a legal technical term.
But if you do it as a legal thing, it's tax deductible.
Right. But there are certain limits that I don't quite understand based on
Your usage restrictions and contribution limits and that sort of thing. You can find all that in Tax Savvy for Small Businesses. When we get to tax strategy, we'll talk about that again.
Yeah. And the old-fashioned way is just to have a savings account that you don't touch that's just for emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pay out of pocket for really basic things like your annual physical and your annual vaccinations,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, those are the things that you know you'll need every year, and you just pay those out of pocket and set aside for anything that is beyond that.
Yep. Now, if you have chronic conditions that require certain prescriptions, you're going to need to actually buy proper health insurance through the exchanges that have good prescription coverage, and that'll be one of your priorities. But if you're not on long-term prescriptions, that's not a big deal.
And even if you are, there are now prescription savings clubs that either find the lowest prescription rates in your area or give you coupons and I've seen
a couple of national pharmacies now that are online that are licensed and proper.
Yeah.
That have amazingly good prices.
I can't recommend any companies right now because I don't remember them.
All right, what else do we need to talk about in terms of finances?
Tax strategy.
Okay, so this is going to be a big one because it can save you up to 50% of your income, depending on how well you do it. Your hobby is a business, and you need to treat it like that from day one. Get a book called Tax Savvy for Small Businesses. Get it every year. Read it every year. Make it part of your annual job to read that book the minute it comes out in the early part of the year. The way that you interact with money that comes in through both your writing business and any other side hustles you have will make a big difference in how much you get to keep, what you can buy pre-tax, and all that sort of stuff. And this is important because your pre-tax dollars are worth $1.50. Once you add up the withholdings for state income, federal income tax, and payroll tax, Medicare, and Social Security, you're dealing with approximately 50% of the paycheck if you're making over about $40,000 a year. If it's under that, it's going to be 20%. Well, a little more than 20%. But anyway, the rule of thumb is it's 50% average across all the tax brackets. And any dollar that you spend that doesn't go through withholding is worth $1.50 of what you get on your personal paycheck, because it doesn't have money stripped out of it before you can use it. So you want to use every dollar you can legally use pre-tax. You want to use that pre-tax. So get to know those books and get to know them very well. And then when you can afford it, also get a tax accountant who is also a tax attorney. Don't get just a tax preparer. Get a proper accountant, a CPA. If they're also a lawyer, that's even better, though they tend to be more expensive. So that you can determine things like corporate structure, long-term strategy, deferments, deferred investments, and all sorts of other fancy stuff. So that will save you money long term. Sometimes it can save you money short term. There was one year when the difference between having a tax strategy and not having a tax strategy for us was the difference between we got to eat and we didn't. Huge difference. And it was because our income that year came from capital gain. And if we hadn't treated it right, we would have lost a lot of it to the tax. So that's all stuff to keep in mind.
And as a side note to that, if you can't regularly afford a tax accountant, use a tax accountant when an unusual situation comes up.
Yes.
Like for us with the capital gains, that was something we never dealt with before, and it was a lot of money at one time. And we needed professional advice on how to deal with it ahead of paying the taxes at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And that saved us a lot more money than we spent on the tax accountant.
A lot more. Orders of magnitude more.
So when you're dealing with a new situation, it's really worthwhile spending it on the tax accountant. And you might not need it regularly and year after year.
Mm-hmm. But you do want to be buying and reading that NOLA press book every year, Tax Savvy for Small Businesses, because it will keep you up to date on the changes in the law.
Yes.
So those are the things, the basic things that you want to consider, plan for, and do when you're looking to go pro from hobbyist. The aggregate of those things will help pull down the income threshold at which you can go pro. They will help you go pro in such a way that you become less fragile going pro than you were as an employee. As an employee, your whole life is over if your boss says you're fired. If you take into account the expense reduction, the long-term planning, the side businesses, and side income streams, you run the gauntlet through all these things, you get to the other side, there is no one thing that can take you offline. You may still be able to get knocked offline by a perfect storm of things, but you no longer have a single point of vulnerability that can kill you. And that's really nice when you're dealing in an unpredictable business like entertainment.
Yes.
You were really scared of going this direction when we started out. You really wanted to be gone from your job, but you were really scared of going this direction. It's now been a few years, and we had some really, really thin years in those years. So you can offer maybe mental outlook and emotional advice from the far side that I couldn't, because I never did well with the whole job thing. And so I was I was always the kind of person who would rather starve than be chained to a desk.
My closing thoughts, honestly, is forethought. Planning ahead saves you a lot in so many areas.
It really does.
In terms of budgeting, in terms of menu planning, in terms of planning major purchases,
mm-hmm.
Thinking ahead will save you a lot. And knowing what you need to think ahead on is possibly the best business advice, is knowing those things.
It really is.
Attitude also is a lot. We know people who are not making it in freelance because the little luxuries mean more to them than the freedom. And if you're going to die when you don't get to have your latte,
this isn't the path for you.
Yeah. You have to be okay with doing without the little luxuries.
It's an important distinction that's worth bringing up, because a lot of those little luxuries are convenience things. And they're sold to you, they'll free you up a little bit of time, a little bit of space of mind, in return for a little bit of money. And that's true insofar as it goes. But what you discover is that the more of those you give up, the more you locate the responsibility for seeing to those same needs closer in, the more freedom you actually get. Because A, you don't have to meet those needs in the way that your preferred supplier is telling you they will sell it to you. And B, meeting them yourself increases your personal power and latitude, because you learn things about the world, about the way things work, and about how to do stuff that are cross-applicable to a whole bunch of other domains. And the less you are allowing yourself to be coddled and infantilized because it plays to your sense of ego and luxury, the more anti-fragile and robust two different things that you're going to be, and the more freedom you have. Money is freedom because it allows you to buy your way out of certain kinds of problems. It allows you to buy your time back. But what happens to most middle-class people who work a day job, even when they make obscenely large salaries, they don't use the money to buy freedom. They use it to buy drugs.
And we don't mean cocaine.
And we don't mean cocaine. We mean those little anodyne pleasures that don't actually increase your well-being or give you a deep sense of satisfaction, but instead numb you to the stress and pain of the day. If you can get yourself out of the trap where you're working in order to afford the luxuries that make the stress from the job bearable, then you can break out all the way. And the first step to that is giving up those luxuries that make the stress from the job bearable and replacing them with responsibilities that cost less money and give you more agency.
Yeah.
And that's good training for all the other things you'll need to be able to do when you're running your own business.
So true.
Freedom! All right. Well, I guess that's it for this episode. What are we talking about next time?
After financial prep is small business education.
Next time we'll follow naturally from this. It'll be small business education, so we will talk about that tomorrow. And until then...
We don't have an until then sign off. It's we'll see you tomorrow. Don't change things up on me without warning me.
And until then...
See ya.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.